Well, just this morning I took the G out of my title to avoid discussions like this, whether they're globular clusters or other, and we'll just talk about cluster formation. I'm going to talk about, since cluster formation is really related to star formation, I want to give an overview of star formation in these environments, and then talk about cluster formation as part of that, and then talk about selection effects, the size of sample effects, that most of the clusters we're seeing, even these very massive clusters, look like they are size of sample choices. There are a few examples of clusters that seem to be much too big for the sample size, and there we may be seeing new physics. So let's begin. I can get out of the way. Mergers have two distinctive features. One is that they could very well have had some globally shocked gas, not necessarily the touching places of two galaxies, which would be a very hot shock. There possibly is an example of that, of a close passage which has left a strip of radio continuum emission off to the side of one galaxy, which is right about where numerical simulations say they should have barely touched. The shocking that is important for star formation is more what could happen half a revolution later when things settle down to a lower temperature, when stars have strong tidal features, density features in the disk that can move the gas around. In addition, there are column density increases from accretion, outside accretion, but also just from torques generated by the stellar density structures that are formed in the response to the tidal perturbations, such as bars and spirals. Nevertheless, in spite of all of those things, Kennicott finds that the star formation versus column density law is somewhat universal. And is there a pointer? Oh, okay. So the laser comes out the end of this? So up here are nuclei, starburst nuclei, intermediate radii, main disks of galaxies. And regardless of how that mass got there, and many of these are starburst type star formation rates, as you would find in mergers, no matter how the gas got there, the star formation law is following a characteristic form. That's also seen in detail, even in the antenna, on scales, 28 parsec averages, 11 parsec averages. The black dots are plotted, the star formation rate versus gas column density for molecular and atomic total gas. The white open circles are just for the atomic gas. The solid line is the Kennicott relation, and the dashed line here is the fit to the data. And even on a local scale, this is showing you're getting this remarkable correlation between star formation rate, solar masses per year per square kiloparsec versus the gas column density. So why should this be? Generally, this kind of relation, you would think, would follow from a property of star formation where you convert available mass at some density into stars at a dynamical rate. That's what's available to you during the star formation process. And you can think of an efficiency out here in terms of what gets sent back. Some gets in at the dynamical rate, and then maybe massive stars turn on and they send some back. Well, on a small scale, we really know what's happening in cores of molecular clouds where the stars are forming. And in the cores, which may have a density of 10 to the fifth or higher, the efficiency of the mass going into stars is not so variable. It may be 10 or 20 or 30% per core. Yet the same kinds of processes happen there. You've got an available core density and an available dynamical time scale, and the formation rate in solar masses per volume per time is about constant in all cores. This is what local physics of star formation tells you should happen. Why is there a connection to galactic scale processes? There's a lot that goes on between the galactic scale and the local core. Why should there be a connection? This threshold density of 10 to the fifth is where a lot of things happen locally. Grains stop gyrating around the magnetic field so that you lose some magnetic support. Molecules freeze out. Ionization fraction drops. Turbulence becomes subsonic. It's natural to have a kind of density threshold at which the support of a cloud cannot exist anymore at that and higher density. What the Schmidt law is then telling you is that for all of these processes, the ratio of the core density to the average density is about constant. And this factor out front is proportional to the fraction of the whole ISM gas that's at this high density. If, in fact, there's a constant efficiency, and there are some papers here now looking at just the molecular part of the gas, the star formation rate scaling linearly with the molecular part of the gas, that would imply that the critical density is constant everywhere. So what should this fraction of the whole ISM at high density be? What would you predict it to be? In the numerical simulations of turbulence, for isothermal turbulence, the density distribution function of density, that is the number of cells, a histogram of the number of cells having certain densities, so log density versus the number of cells having that log density, tends to be a log normal, or in this case, log, it's the parabola. If it's not isothermal, but say adiabatic turbulence, the parts of this will straighten into power law pieces. This is a simulation from Wada and Norman for a large piece of a galaxy with two thermal phases, star formation, supernova pressures, gas moving around with proper hydrodynamics of turbulence. And in that very complicated situation, with or without star formation, they still get a log normal density distribution. The width of that is a dimensionless quantity that depends on the Mach number, and they've tuned their parameter to look like a galaxy, so they have about the right Mach number. If we were to ask what fraction of the gas is at high density, we could integrate this function for densities larger than 10 to the fifth times the average. So that would be way out here, higher density than what Wada and Norman would simulate. But if our galaxy and general ISM turbulence gives this kind of structure, that's a straightforward exercise. And the answer is that about 10 to the minus fourth of the gas has a mass, of the gas mass has a density larger than this, either 10 to the fifth limit or larger than the average by 10 to the fifth. So in a whole ISM that's quite turbulent, only 10 to the minus 4 of the gas is really doing that star formation process, and the rest isn't. The rest is at lower density, it's moving too fast, it's not in a dense enough form. What is the observed fraction? If we go back to the Kennicott relation, this is the column density divided by the dynamical time, and you could write the so-called Schmidt law in that same way instead of a power 1.4 of column density, it's the power 1 of column density divided by dynamical time. This is average for a whole galaxy, so assuming an exponential disk, I can convert that into a star formation rate per unit volume to get this coefficient out front. And the star formation rate per unit volume is the rate per unit mass in the core times the core mass fraction, and that's that fraction we're looking for, times the mass per unit volume in the galaxy. And that I can set equal to the star formation rate per mass in the core is this amount. It's the core efficiency times that dynamical time in the core. This is that fraction of the mass, and there's the density. And I can equate that now to what Kennicott observes to find, again, that the mass fraction of gas producing this relationship is 10 to the minus 4. In other words, we can explain the normal Schmidt law as a result of turbulence, where only a very small fraction of the gas is actually involved in the star formation process, and everywhere the gas is progressing towards star formation on the dynamical timescale. Or I can invert this and say that this, what you may have thought of as an efficiency when I told you that OB associations disrupt the gas and stop star formation, that that was this innate inefficiency. In fact, that is derived from first principles in the same way, just by inverting these equations. That's the local efficiency in the core, which is only going to be about 0.3 or 0.5. There's not much variation in that. The collapsed models find locally fairly high efficiency, times this ratio, times the mass fraction of the gas. And that would suggest that, no, the efficiency of star formation in galaxies is not the result of cloud disruption stopping the process. It's a result of the fact that most of the gas cannot be at high density because of what turbulence does in moving gas around. That means that the relationship, the correlation between star formation and column density looks more like a saturation effect, not a fine-tuning of star formation rates. Star formation rate depends on the mass fraction. Turbulence may determine this in a universal way, independent of the sources of stirring, whether it's a merger or a supernova or density waves. Anything that's turbulent will give you that mass fraction. So the fine-tuning in the sense of feedback is not necessary. Saturation, though, in the sense that all the gas that can form stars is doing it already. Now, you can still have blowout, you can still have heating, and that's what's required to stop star formation. The only way to stop it is by conversion to a pure warm phase, where the supersonic turbulence or compressive turbulence stops. And that's observed outer parts of galaxies, dwarfs, low surface brightness galaxies, and blowout regions. Okay. While this is happening, of course, the turbulence makes patterns. The patterns are hierarchical, shown here, and this is, by the way, that interacting system where there's a radio continuum ridge right up here in the hydrogen, or in the radio continuum, 21 centimeter. We can look at patches of star formation and blur them and do the standard box counting and find that they are fractal, get the slope of that to get the fractal dimension. This is 8 galaxies here, 5 regions in this galaxy. Model that to projected fractals. It is definitely not Poisson. It has a fractal dimension that's about the same as observed for interstellar gas. A similar study showed an autocorrelation of star-forming regions, which you heard about in Francois' talk a minute ago. Not only are there big patches of star formation, but the clusters are clustered and clustered within those patches. It's a ever more clustering on smaller and smaller scales, up to about a kiloparsec. That continues even to very small cores of clouds where clusters are forming. When you look at a cluster that's very young, and this is the center of Ophiuchus, these tiny dots here are radio submillimeters continuum sources. They are clustered within clusters with the same self-similar hierarchical structure as are much bigger regions of star formation. This is now seen in several embedded infrared sources. This will probably end up looking like a cluster, but the stars have not mixed yet to give you that isothermal profile. It's still hierarchical. Okay, so now why are there clusters? And when does star formation make a superstar cluster? You've seen that turbulence makes the gas fractal or hierarchical, power law, power spectra. The star-forming regions in that gas have the same structure. They're also correlated in time in the sense that larger regions take longer to form systematically with a power law slope between the duration of star formation and the size that is the same as the crossing time versus size relation for interstellar turbulence. So everything is happening on about 2 dynamical times regardless of scale. The mass spectra in these regions is expected to be around m to the minus 2, and that's what we see for both OB associations and clusters. Whereas the cloud mass spectrum, as you saw a few minutes ago, is a bit shallower. Where do these mass spectra come from? Well, turbulence, as I mentioned, makes a kind of structure like this. And once we want a mass spectrum, we have to define an object that we characterize as a thing, a cloud. We have to draw boundaries. In the case of clusters, it's a bit easier. So let's draw boundaries here. Let's threshold the intensity here and look at what the mass spectrum is. If we clip it very close to the peak density, we get a mass spectrum that's fairly steep, slope of minus 2.3. If we clip it lower down, the mass spectrum gets shallower and shallower. If we clip now at 3/100ths of the peak, which is still a factor of 100 denser than the lowest density, you find a mass spectrum that's a bit shallower, minus 1.7 for a slope. It gets shallower because as we climb down the fractal, we're including more and more of the low-density gas that's between the peaks. So the mass starts climbing more. We pick up more massive objects. So it's not unreasonable that clouds, simply defined by contouring of molecular line maps or atomic line maps, are sampling down to the map threshold, which is a low value, much lower than the peak, would have a shallower slope than the clusters which are forming in the cores. On average, it's about a slope of 2, but it can depend on how it's sampled. This power spectrum of mass is not because the density has any power law behavior. In these distributions, the density is log normal. It's because the sizes of the clouds are power law. And that's a characteristic of a fractal structure, a characteristic of turbulence, where you have velocity and length scales correlated, giving a sizes and time scales correlated. You tend to get power law size structures, but not power law density structures. Why should the mass end up a power law mass spectrum? Primarily because most of the mass is along the periphery of a region. This shows the mass versus size for all of the objects that are found. And there are some dense regions or small regions, but by and large, the mass is following the cube of the size, or it would be the square in projection. Okay, so turbulent motions produce scale-free density structures and power law mass spectra with some average power around -2. Cluster and Obi association mass spectra probably result from sampling this, which doesn't mean that turbulence forms the clusters, say by compression. They can form by any process that operates on gas that is pre-structured in this way. So any triggering process, compression of pre-existing clouds, collisions of clouds, spontaneous collapse of clouds, the turbulence is structuring the gas, the star formation in that gas, then gives the cluster mass spectrum. So these spectra do not reveal the star formation process. Now, we have a broad range of masses that can form in a turbulent gas. Are clusters randomly sampled from this mass distribution? Whitmore showed a couple years ago that the mass of the most massive cluster increases with the number of clusters or the total star formation rate. So this is a diagram from Larson's recent paper showing the star formation rate per unit area times the area. So this is the total star formation rate in the galaxy in solar masses per year. And the magnitude MV of the brightest cluster. So as there are more clusters, the brightest cluster gets brighter. The line here is what you expect from random sampling the cluster mass function. The slope of that line just comes from here. If the number versus mass in the mass interval dm goes as m to the minus x, that can be normalized by integrating from some maximum mass out to infinity to give one cluster there. That gives the constant. So then the total number just goes as the largest cluster to a power x minus 1. So if the power is 2 here, then the number of clusters goes as the first power of the maximum mass. Larson also modeled the width of this statistically by sampling clusters from a distribution like this, showed that on average the width is several magnitudes, which is about the width here. Then in addition, Larson and Richtler showed that at high star formation rates per unit area, so the mergers are here and our galaxy's down here, the fraction of the ultraviolet light that comes out from young clusters as opposed to dispersed light increases. The slope here is about 1. Why is this? This is saying something more than just the most massive cluster. It looks like there's a change in physics as you go to higher star formation rates, because you're finding more things forming in the form of clusters rather than as loose Obi associations. Well, there are several effects here. First of all, we know that from infrared surveys, Carpenter showed, for example, in 2000, that most stars form in clusters. 90% is what he said. And these clusters fairly quickly disperse. By 10 million years or so, only 10% of the stars are in clusters. The maximum fraction here, this is as a percentage, this is 10%. So if we look at regions that are 10 million years old, we should see 10% of the light coming out as clusters, because that's what's left. If we look at regions that are much, much older, then even those clusters have dispersed, and the fraction should go down. But this slope is too steep to explain in that way. I've tried to model that, and I can only get a slope of about 0.3. So there's another explanation. Is it size of sample? Is there some additional physics happening, which would be interesting to know about? First of all, this is defined to be the fraction of the ultraviolet light from massive clusters having a maximum on that previous diagram that is about 10%. And as I said, that's what we see locally for 10 million year associations. The total cluster mass, which is part of that, is the integral over the mass spectrum that scales mostly with the mass of the largest cluster. So this fraction here is the total cluster mass divided by the star formation rate, total star formation rate. That's a fraction of the light coming out in the form of clusters. So that is scaling with the largest mass divided by the total star formation rate. And all I've used for this is sampling from the mass function. This could be for dense clusters or unbound OB associations. So there seems to be a physical part required also. From the virial theorem and cluster pressure, which has this expression, it depends on the Kalmanczy squared of the mass in the cluster, there's an upper limit to the mass of a bound cluster. More massive clusters require much larger pressures. So for example, the pressure in the molecular cloud that's forming the cluster in Orion is around 10 to the 8. It's much higher than the ambient ISM pressure because of self-gravity. To get a much more massive cluster, you need more massive pressure, and you have a high density because that's what's defining a cluster. This corresponds to about 10 to the 4th or so solar masses per cubic parsec, typical cluster densities. Now, the Kennicott star formation law tells you that the star formation rate per unit area goes as the surface density, the 1.4, and by the self-gravity, the ISM, the pressure goes as the surface density squared. So the upper mass limit to a cluster should be scaling with a star formation rate per unit area squared. So this fraction of ultraviolet light coming out in the form of clusters, which had the upper mass limit to within a logarithmic factor in the numerator, is scaling with the square of the star formation rate per unit area divided by the total star formation rate. So the Larson and Rickler relation, where the slope was 1, would hold if all the galaxies have about the same area, which in fact they do. So in that sample, it just happened that all the galaxies had about the same area, several hundred square kiloparsecs. What this means is that mergers have more bright clusters and more massive brightest clusters because they have more clusters overall, and that's the size of sample effect, and because they have more star formation overall, which means the surface densities are higher, the pressures are higher, and the largest mass that can be formed as a cluster is higher. But there are interesting exceptions to this. So for example, in dwarf galaxies, and this is the size of these lower three are the size of sample effect again. Here's the star formation rate total versus the luminosity of the brightest cluster. That's the squared dependence I mentioned before. Total cluster luminosity, or the number of clusters. And this is the rate per unit area, which has a shallower dependence. So the ratio of these two is the Larson and Rickler law. The odd guys here, which have too bright a largest cluster for the number of clusters, are dwarf galaxies. And these dwarfs often look very disturbed. Some have near neighbors. So it's possible that there was an excursion to give a few, a statistically insignificant number of very high mass clusters in tidal shocks. Another exception where extraordinarily massive clusters are forming are in the nuclei of some galaxies. Here in NGC 253, several thousand O stars without the usual distribution of many clusters. NGC 5253, again, the equivalent of several thousand O stars. If these are single clusters, they would lie here on this Whitmore diagram of log of the number versus log of the magnitude. So there may be some regions where the size of sample effect has yet more physics to to give extra massive clusters. Here's another place. This is a galactic shock here. These are two grazing galaxies, and that kind of structure occurs during an interaction as a caustic from the first response within a half an orbit time to the tidal forces. So it would be along here. Gas simulations show the same kind of structure. And in that ridge, there are two or three massive clusters. There are not a whole lot of other clusters. There are other clusters for sure, but there are an unusually large number of massive clusters just in that place. Elsewhere in these galaxies, there are massive clusters. Overall, the mass distribution in both galaxies is not so unusual. It's shown here. That blue line is a power law of 2. It may be a little shallower here, but the sampling is so poor we can't say. Here's a very odd cluster with what looks like a infrared cone coming out one end, a very dark cloud here. There's a massive cluster still embedded there. And this is an interesting point. If we look at particular and peculiar regions of galaxies where there may be unusually large pressures, it seems possible that unusually massive clusters are forming there. But averaged over the whole galaxy, the mass function could be normal. We can say the same about turbulent regions. In turbulent simulations, you remember I told you that the density distribution was log normal. The same is true for pressure. We can have an average pressure in a galaxy, but there will be excursions of high pressure when gas flows happen to collide temporarily and give you a region, maybe a factor of 10 higher pressure. This comes from a numerical simulation. And high pressure regions like this have been seen in the local interstellar medium, a factor of 10 higher than average. So there are possibilities of pressure excursions, but on average in a galaxy, there appears to be a much more uniformity, giving these characteristic power law mass functions for clusters, giving size of sample effects almost everywhere we look. I was just going to remind you how important local triggering is. Here's Orion, and right in this region here, a cluster is forming. And in this region down here, the lower one has a comet tail of CO and a head here, forming stars in a rather flat region that abuts the H2 region. The head of a big comet tail up near the Horsehead Nebula, and another, that previous one that you saw here near the trapezium, that's where all of the dense gas is, and that's where all of the embedded infrared clusters are. In the case of Ophiuchus, I showed you the submillimeter survey in the core of the Ophiuchus. This is the IRAS map. There are models of timing and pressure which suggest that that was just triggered by the Skocen association. In fact, most of the clusters in the solar neighborhood, over a dozen, are right next to strong H2 regions in cometary-shaped clouds. Yamaguchi, in two studies, has suggested that, in fact, most star formation is near H2 regions, either between 10 and 50% of all star formation in the inner Milky Way and in the LMC are adjacent to high-pressure H2 regions. And in the case of NGC 6946, where there's a young globular cluster at the end of a spiral arm, shown here with the HST, that has about 2 million solar masses, the star formation history in the environment from modeling the a color magnitude diagram shows a rather low hump of star formation here. And then the young superstar cluster formed during a lull in the background star formation at about 15 million years. And then since that time, there's been an increase in star formation. And it's possible in terms of timing and pressure, considering the energy that this put out, that the first generation of star formation in the region compressed a molecular cloud, making that superstar cluster, and these presumably are the remnants, these dark patches of that molecular cloud now blown away from the superstar cluster. So even that could be an example of local triggering. Averaged over a whole galaxy, that's just in the tail of the turbulent pressure distribution. Okay, so to summarize, most superstar clusters, even in mergers, look like normal clusters. Their high masses are not surprising based on the large numbers. Their compactness requires high pressure, but in most regions, these high pressures follow from the self-gravity of the ISM, which gives the average pressure, and that was what I showed you at the very beginning, or in terms of the Larson and Rickler relation, how the average pressure scales with the star formation rate. Plus, high pressure fluctuations from many sources that increase the local environmental pressure, such as from an H2 region, plus the self-gravity of the core, which multiplies the pressure up by another factor of 100. This last factor might be modulated a bit if, for example, magnetic diffusion rates are much faster in low metallicity regions, because then the core can sink down to a denser and a higher pressure structure. In the case of mergers, the high pressure of the environment can give you the same factor of 100 from a galactic shock rather than an H2 region. That's just what you get if you compress material moving about 10 times faster than the normal turbulent speed. That's about what orbit speeds are. So you can get clusters that are very comparable to clusters forming in H2 regions with masses that go all the way up simply from galactic processes. And then you'd have the extra factor of 100 from gravity. So deviations from this normal mode, from size of sample expectations, the Kennicott-Schmidt law, if we could find deviations, they would reveal unusual physical processes. But examples of these deviations, and some that I showed you, maybe dwarf galaxies, maybe a caustic and a grazing collision galaxy, that ridge of high pressure, galactic nuclei where this last factor can be very large. Examples of deviations are still pretty rare. So far, it looks like what we're seeing is expected based on statistics of turbulent interstellar medium.
Yeah, I just wanted to briefly discuss the significance of that density of 10 to the 5 particles per cubic mm-hmm. centimeter. The simplest way of getting that is just equating the thermal pressure in 10K gas at that mm-hmm. density with the turbulent ram pressure in the cloud, right. Which of course is what you're saying is that the turbulence becomes super subsonic right, at that right. density. That's the same statement, of course. Now, if that's what's doing it, then you're going to get a different density threshold in different environments. Whereas if it's microphysics that does it, then it's actually this 10 to the 5, which is the constant between different environments. Right. Now, in local GMCs, the two scales are the same, so we can't say anything. So I just right. wonder what your feelings right. are
in
about
that. List of what can happen at 10 to the 5, grains stop gyrating. That's a frictional effect. So there's if the grains have the same size from mantles, that would happen. Grains, the gas freezing out onto the grains, that again is a timing, a balance between radiative processes on grains and freezing. That shouldn't, I mean, that could vary with environment, but it's quite different than the turbulent effect you mentioned. Probably a mixture of things can lead to this catastrophe at around that density or slightly higher. And we can't tell locally because of this coincidence.
Exactly.
But it
yes.
sure would be interesting to look at odd regions.
Yep.
Yeah.
Well, this is a question for basically all the speakers this morning. We have kind of two different groups of people here. Many of us do sort of long-term dynamical simulations of individual global clusters and rarely worry about really how realistic our initial conditions are, and very, very rarely think about things like star formation and all that. So my question is, what would be, let's say you're going to do a 2 months long gigantic n-body simulation of a global cluster, and you want to get it right, and you want to pick a reasonable initial condition. Based on all this knowledge we have now about the star formation processes and observations of young clusters, what would be, if you had to pick one, what would be the best initial condition to use?
Right.
density profile.
There are some oddities.
And substructure.
Density profile, yeah, I guess you'd pick power law. But an oddity is that the massive stars look like they want to form near the center. That seems to be independent of dynamical relaxation. What implications that has for subsequent evolution, I don't know, but you'd think it might be important.
Enormous.
Yeah.
I mean, many of the things that have been discussed here this morning, basically, I think, are never taken into account.
Gas clearing.
N-body simulation.
Gas clearing is an important part of the initial cluster evolution. Can be catastrophic, make the difference between immediately unbound or not. So Krupa has done this kind of simulation, including binary interactions, and has made reasonable-looking clusters, has shown that the Pleiades can be made from the Orion cluster with the right time scale and so on. How much the hierarchical structure of the protostars matters is hard to say. It could, because the binding energy is different when it's hierarchical. Could possibly lead to enhanced binary formation at an early stage, because turbulence tells you that things born closer together also have more similar velocities. So they're more likely to be self-bound than if they just had the total burial speed. And binary formation is enormously important for subsequent cluster evolution. So I think there are details well known in local observations of clusters that, as you say, are not into simulations again yet. They could be important.
Substructure certainly is something that could have a huge effect.
I would think so.
And if you have a lot of substructure, obviously, it seems to me you could effectively decrease very substantially the effective initial relaxation time in the systems.
Yeah.
And that, as far as I know, has never been really looked at by anybody.
Yeah.
Let alone initial mass segregation, where that's like having a,
people have known that for a long time.
Zero time.
What's new about that is it's happening, this segregation, in clusters so young, including, by the way, this Ophiuchus cluster, where there are not even stars yet, there's submillimeter continuum sources that have a stellar-like IMF. That has a mass segregation also. Looks like it's put in from the beginning and not a dynamical relaxation time. That's a new result.
Perhaps I misunderstood what Fred was saying, but I believe that substructure would have the effect of violent relaxation, because the scattering centers don't distinguish between high and low mass stars, so it would not produce mass segregation.
I just meant that if the dynamical time is set by the mass of the system, if effectively n is smaller because of substructure, you can get a smaller relaxation time. I mean, that obviously depends on the details of the substructure. But if you had strong clumping, I mean, you still have to wait for whatever the effective relaxation time system is.
I think there are two points, right? There could be initial mass segregation and substructure. So there really is no reason not to assume there's substructure, right? Both either observational or theoretically.
There are only two embedded infrared clusters that have been observed well enough with enough stars to see hierarchical substructure. It's consistent with everyone having it.
And the second question, this is following what Fred said, this is sort of why the rules are doing it, is with the you just said the density profile should be a power law, but the details of that can actually matter. I mean, what the slope should be, and of course the power law is too shallow, you have to decide to cut it off. I mean, does it just cut? I mean, it can't go on forever. There must be some dynamical time scale or something that sets the outer radius. If it's too steep, you need to do something in the center.
So far, embedded cluster mass, light profiles, starcom profiles, are comparable to what the gas is showing. So it looks like it's following the gas, but that can't be true all the way. I mean, the gas is clumpy. It could, in principle, because there are clumps out there. But you would expect other things to change. But very little is known about that observation.
That's roughly r to the minus 2 in projection.
Approximately.
No,
it's about isothermal. R minus 1 in projection.
R minus 2. Yeah. But that puts a lot of the cluster out. It actually makes these things easy to unbound. If you start with the cluster that diffuse, I think it makes it easier to unbound than a lot of the initial conditions I've seen. You know, R^-2 has a lot of stuff out at large radii.
Is Soren here? That cluster in NGC 6946 has a the young globular cluster 10 to the 6th solar mass. That has a power law all the way out to 50 parsecs. Most of the mass is way out there, and it's probably not bound. Look, although the core radius is less than 11 parsecs.
So,
maybe not even truncated. But that's pretty low density. So you can get out, include 10 to the 6 solar masses and not even get near that. Eventually you would, yeah.
Yeah, just to back up some of that, Becky Elson, for her thesis work a long time ago, looked at the density profiles of young star clusters in the Magellanic Clouds and found that in all cases they had profiles in the outer regions that were approximated by power laws, where the space density was going like r to the minus 2 or r to the minus 2.5, and they didn't show any sign of a truncation for the young clusters. So all the ones she looked at had that property.
Just wanted to respond to Fred's question about substructure, because Aylwin Scally and I looked at this in the context of the Orion Nebula cluster. That's young, that's only 2 million years old. We put in fractal initial conditions, and it had all gone by 2 million years. So it's not significant for your initial spatial distributions. It's not particularly significant for the mass segregation either. What's far more significant for mass segregation is what happens in the hydrodynamic stage, and it seems that indeed does produce things which are primordially mass segregated, but I don't think it's predominantly a two-body effect.
Let's think